Talking about the cold open is a terrible cold open.
The meta cold open.
This isn't meta. This is just lazy.
Yeah. Welcome to another episode of Jabber and the Drone, the movie review podcast that politely disagrees to agree. With me again is my regular co-host from San Diego, California, Keith Foster.
And with me is my co-host from Los Angeles, California, in the red corner, it's Cassidy Robinson. What's up, Jabberjaws and Drone Strikes?
I was a little bit more announcery this time around, wasn't I?
Were you? No, I was just like, I need to spice it up. I need to get in the game.
Yeah.
So I have a new job that allows me to listen to music and podcasts at work, which is like my dream. But I'm burning through them real fast.
Yeah.
Real fast. And I've been listening to a bunch of My Brother and Me, and
I listen to like 4 podcasts at this point. I really scaled back.
No,
and most of them are people I know personally.
I pretty much do too. Yeah, I just got into My Brother and Me. There's a huge backlog, and it's bad because I work in a cubicle, and it makes me laugh out loud.
So I know.
I sound insane.
I know. So, I told you. Like,
just imagine, though, this quiet cubicle. The office is way too quiet because everyone is listening to their own individual music and podcasts and stuff.
Yeah.
And then there's just me, like, trying to suppress laughter because of whatever the ridiculous goddamn thing they said.
Yeah. No, I know. I told you that they're too funny for work.
Yeah.
There are some podcasts that have to go into that category.
No, I mean, it makes my day better. And until I get talked to about it, it's going to keep happening. But so my point is, we can't do Choose Your Own Adventure cold open. So just did that.
Opening ramble. Yeah, okay. Then I'll just choose for us. I'll go with the story I was going to tell about me going to a hardcore show in Highland Park.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, we'll go with that one. So a few weeks ago, I saw that the California-based power violence band Nails was playing a show.
Violence isn't a thing.
It's a thing. It's the angrier cousin of heavy metal and hardcore punk.
Okay.
And it was going on over in Highland Park, which I don't live anywhere near. That's Marc Maron territory, by the way. I think that's where he lives. And
stalker.
It says at the top of his show from Highland Park.
Anybody interested? Neighborhood.
But, so I wanted to go to the show, and I enjoy the band. I enjoy listening to their music, but I'm well aware that I'm...
Okay, you know what? What did you even call this type of music?
Power violence?
Power violence? And you're like, I enjoy listening to this music.
Exactly. Well, that's where I'm going with this story. I
quite enjoy listening to power violence.
Yeah, I mean,
it really gets my blood up.
Arguably grindcore, but let's not split hairs.
No one is.
But I'm well aware that I'm way too nerdy for this band. Like, they are pretty much, they sound like what anger feels like. And, that's what I like about them, but I also, like, you know, the name of their last album is You Will Never Be One of Us. And also the name of their...
Of suppression.
Right.
Like, if there was an award for suppressed emotions, well, they wouldn't give it out because they would be too afraid that whoever won it would emote.
Mm.
But you would win it.
Okay. I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing, but...
No, it's a bad thing.
Okay.
It's definitely a bad thing. You are unhealthy. And one day you are just going to explode.
I get all of that out in the car when I'm yelling at people who, for whatever reason, sneak up to green lights.
I actually not to get we are like hitting every podcast that I listen to today, but not to get too Pete Holmes, but I have a bit about that.
So I decide whatever, fuck it, I'm gonna go, you know, this is the closest thing is like being able to see Black Flag during their prime or whatever. So I bought the ticket and like sat on it for a couple of weeks being like, I just don't know if I'm gonna like live through this. I was telling people at work about it and like, you know, being like, I don't know, like, you know, this band, they're pretty heavy, they're pretty intense. And then I posted it online, and I was like, okay, well, I bought the tickets. We'll see what happens. And a friend of mine who lives down here was all like, so where are you playing? Where are they playing? I'm like, the Hi-Hat? And she's like, oh, yeah, you're going to die. I'm like, why? And she's like, it's a really small venue, and the stage is pretty much just right there. So I'm like, okay. And then our friends, Chris and Hillary, I posted a video because someone asked who they were. And Hillary posted something to the effect of, like, yeah, we'll mourn your loss.
But you survived.
I did survive. And the reason why is because the setup, they were right. It's like a long, like, billiards bar that they converted into a music venue. And they put the stage, against the wall and on the lengthwise. So you actually have less space from the wall to the stage. So it is very intimate, but, they have like these little bleacher things in the back that I stood on while all the kids got to, you know, circle pit and do their thing.
I mean, did it really get that crazy?
No, there was first of all, there was like 900 bands, because whenever a semi-popular hardcore band comes into town, that means like 900 of the less popular local bands try and tag on to the bill.
Sure.
And play like a 5-minute set, which can probably run through half of their catalog.
Yeah.
But yeah, so there was
You know what? Can I say,
yeah,
since we're talking about music, I'm over opening acts.
Just the concept thereof.
Yeah, I'm just like... So, Ashley and I went to see the old 97s recently, and we got there at 7, because that's, like, the normal time that they do concerts. Is it the Belly Up where I took you?
Oh, right.
Warhols.
Mm-hmm.
And so, we got there at 7, and then we looked at the tickets that said the doors didn't even open until 8:30.
Mm-hmm.
And we were just like, oh, Jesus. So we, you know, we went, got dinner, and then, you know, the doors opened at 8:30. The opening band didn't start till like 9.
Right.
And there's their bullshit, which I don't care about because I've never heard of you. And they were fine. They were whatever. And then, the band comes out, and we're both just like over it. We're just, like, done. Ready to go.
Why don't you just go later, then?
No. That's like those people who go to the movies intentionally late to miss the trailers.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, you can't time it right. You don't know. You don't know. And I don't want to be that person, like, just strolling in. Like, just, no. I'd rather show up early, see two songs from the band I'm there to see, and then leave.
Is that what you ended up doing?
Yeah. They were free tickets, so it's not like we're really committed. If I'd paid money for it, it'd be a different thing. But I'm over opening bands. I'm over late night concerts. Papa needs
You're
to
such
sleep.
A grown-up. It's so sad.
It really is.
I sat through... Not only to get to Nails, I had to sit through like three LA hardcore bands I've never heard of, and then a death metal band called Gate Creeper, then a thrash revival band called Toxic Holocaust.
All of these are the same music.
They're not.
All of these are the same.
And then, like, an old school, like, punk band that actually felt bad for them, because that was kind of when everyone decided to take their cigarette break or whatever. And I got a headache, like a splitting headache, about midway through all of this. Like, I had, like, three bands before I even got to see the band I wanted to see, and I was, like, literally had to, like, not look at the lights in between sets because it was making my migraine worse. And Nails was by far the most noisy and chaotic of all of the bands I played. But I sat through the entire thing.
And you should have been in the pit. This wasn't a headache. This was your emotions trying to get out.
I might have. I felt like my head was going to explode like a guy in Scanners. Speaking of movies, that's what this podcast is actually about. And today we're going to be talking about Ghost in the Shell, the remake, the American live-action remake. And we will be talking about Frailty in our Netflix homework, which I assigned you last week. Mm-hmm. We have movie news. We've been putting it off. I'll start with this one. Robert Downey Jr. is in talks to head a new Dr. Doolittle movie, as Dr. Doolittle himself.
He'll be the talking tiger.
Yeah. That would probably be a better move, honestly.
Okay. So you're not into this?
I'm not. Here's my thing. I actually think it's sort of...
It's not Iron Man?
It's not... Robert Downey Jr. Actually, it's really interesting to me that Robert Downey Jr. is taking this step, because it feels almost like his career is starting to mirror that of Eddie Murphy's. I feel like... once upon a time, Eddie Murphy used to be this, like, interesting, funny, subversive, comedic actor, right?
Yeah.
And then along the way, he has kids, so he decides he wants to be in some movies they're allowed to see. He starts with Dr. Doolittle, which everyone kind of liked, you know? Like, no one had huge opinions about it, but they were like, it's nice. And then... three movies later.
Fast forward
to Pluto 25 Nash.
25 years, and he's doing Norbit.
Exactly.
The movie that cost him an Academy Award.
And Robert Downey Jr., again, not quite this. I guess he comes from a comedic pedigree because he was once on SNL and that kind of stuff. But, subversive, interesting, young actor, cocaine problems, has a big rise and fall, comeback story, blah, 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 Iron Man, then, Sherlock, and now he's the biggest thing in the world. And I feel like ever since he's been the biggest thing in the world, he's taken less and less risks as an actor. He's pretty much just living on Iron Man money at this point, and he really doesn't do anything that isn't franchise-y anymore. And it's sad, because to me, my favorite roles of his are stuff like Zodiac, or stuff like, Scanner Darkly, like his offbeat stuff.
Yeah, but I mean, both of those were kind of when he was on his comeback. That was when it was like, oh yeah, Robert Downey Jr., where the fuck they find him?
Mm-hmm.
You can't cast him that way anymore. He's a megastar. He is like one of the biggest actors in Hollywood. So he probably would like to do, more sort of supporting, interesting character stuff, but probably, his agent probably doesn't even give him that shit anymore. I think he's seasoned enough in his career. I think I see him going more the Johnny Depp route than the Eddie Murphy route, which isn't all too different. Just like overexposing himself and people getting so familiar with his quirks, that they stop working. They have a diminishing return. Like, nobody gives a fuck about Jack Sparrow. And,
Right, right.
All of the personal politics aside, with him as, Johnny Depp as a human being, we were all rooting for Robert Downey Jr. because he already sort of had that sorted past, and it seems like he's kept a pretty clear head. I think it's just, like, it's hard to find quality work like that with the pay grade he's in.
Right.
I don't think it's necessarily his fault. I think it's just, I think he should kind of take a step back, you know, if he's not going to be doing the Iron Man stuff as much, which, you know, there will come a time when someone else will be Iron Man or they'll just kill the character off.
Yeah.
You know, I think at that point, he should just kind of take a step back from the limelight and recalibrate. As far as Dr. Doolittle goes, I just kind of don't care. I think it's like that weird lawyer movie. Like, no one will really give a shit.
Yeah, I don't think it... I mean, it would have to be especially bad to hurt his career. Yeah. I mean, it would have to be just a super embarrassment. And I don't think... I agree. Even if it was that bad, like Alec Baldwin in Boss Baby, it's not going to hurt him.
Yeah, exactly.
And same with this. Or, like, you know, fucking Kevin Spacey in that ridiculous cat movie.
Yeah.
Like, I think he'll... But, you know, he doesn't have a house of cards to lean back on. And if he keeps going this direction, keeps making, you know, the safe kind of padlum...
But he could. I mean, you know, and that's the thing. Again, in his... He'll be at the point... I mean, he is at the point where if he really wanted a TV series, I'm sure people would just, like, jerk him off in his faces.
I don't know if that would get him the job, sentence. Maybe?
Because, A, it implies that writers ejaculate scripts, and B, it implies that he is a multi-faced Hydra beast.
Next story.
Next story that I have is Seth Rogen and Evan Goldberg to adapt Robert Kirkman's comic book Invincible for Universal.
Does now, it say in the story that you have if it's a TV or a film?
I was just actually looking for that. From the sound of it being Universal, sounds like it might be... It looks like, just from this article, it's a movie. Which I have mixed feelings about this. I appreciate Seth Rogen and Evan Goldberg. Out of you, me, and Richard, I'm the only one that enjoyed Sausage Party.
There is that.
We're not going there.
I don't want to relitigate Sausage Party.
We're not. That's not what this story is about. My point is, as filmmakers, they are definitely flawed, but they take risks, and I'm usually excited to see what happens when they do stuff together. You know, like it's usually a conversation. Is something you get out of it. But I'm also, like, I wasn't super crazy about their adaptation of Preacher. That's not what I want for Invincible. And I have been wanting an Invincible movie since that fucking Mark Wahlberg Invincible football movie came out, which I worked at, I worked at the movie theater at the time, I think, and I saw that on the list of trailers coming up. No, because that was before I read Invincible. Whatever. At some point, I saw a trailer for Invincible, and I was like, what the fuck? And then I watch it, and it's this bullshit Mark Wahlberg football Rudy thing. And I'm like, that's not what what this is. How could they even call it Invincible? But, you know, Invincible as a property is... ripe for adaptation, and I've been you know, hoping that something would happen, so I'm cautiously optimistic.
I never watched their adaptation of Preacher. It's kind of funny how, like, there's these dream projects I've had in my head forever that I'm like, oh god, if they could just do this comic, it'd be so cool, this is how I do the show, blah blah blah. And then as soon as they get put on AMC, I just completely lose interest. And I'm not even 100% sure why. In the case of The Walking Dead, I got about six episodes in, and I was just really disappointed with their entire aesthetic approach.
I got three seasons in, and it never got better. It only got worse. And from what I hear, it's still getting worse.
Right. It's kind of what I've heard, too. And I saw the trailers for their Preacher series, and I saw, like, you know, the casting choices and stuff. And, again, I just, like, knowing their sensibilities, I was always kind of hesitant about their adaptation of that show, because I feel like that's super touchy material that has to be done just right for it to work at all.
Well, I mean, the problem with Preacher is kind of the same problem as Walking Dead. It's on AMC. They have to change stuff. They have to edit. And a book like Preacher, it's just not the same. And so I watched, I've seen a couple episodes. I saw the panel at Comic-Con, and it's fine. I will say it's at least more entertaining than Walking Dead. The show definitely does have a dark sense of humor about it, like the book. It's like, tonally, it is pretty close. My big issue with it is it's on AMC, so they don't have the budget, and it was very static. Like, the whole thing took place in this one town, and it sort of became like this Preacher origin story to kind of get away from the fact that they don't have a budget. And I'm like, fuck that. That's not Preacher. Preacher is a sprawling Western. Like, you get that you've got the sense of humor, you've got the fucked upness, but you don't have the core story, which is a Western. Mm-hmm. The book makes no bones about that. They constantly allude to it. So to keep it all stuck in one location is just like a disservice to the story. And so that irked me about it. And again, it's just like, if it was on, if it had HBO money coming at it, we'll talk. But it's not my Preacher, and that's okay. Other people enjoy the show very much who would probably hate the book because of how fucked up it is. and I've decided that's for them, but TV Preacher's not for me. Hopefully movie Invincible will be. Especially if they push for all of the graphic violence that comes with that book. I think they could get away with that easy. You can always get away with more violence, and there's not a whole lot of swearing or sex that defines the book. It's really the hyper-violence that does. So,
yeah. I mean, I've read a little bit of Invincible. I haven't read all of it, but I think I read the first volume.
It is insanely violent. It is graphically violent.
It is, but it's also, I mean, it is kind of a big love letter to, like, superhero comic book media in general.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, one of the premises of the book is a look at Superman's strength versus a normal human. You know, his punches would explode heads.
Right. And that could be funny, and I don't know. So I think they are audacious, but sometimes I don't think that they're that smart about their choices.
Yeah, and sometimes I think they let their passion get in the way of practicality. Like, they're like, we can do an Invincible movie. Fuck yeah, we're gonna do that. But it's not, should we do it? Is that the best for the story? Or should we maybe hook somebody else up with this that might fit the tone better?
Yeah, I guess we'll see. Okay, the last one I have here is Paul Greengrass to direct another... Or do we want to do the other one?
I want to do the other one. I don't...
Okay.
Your story is Paul Greengrass is adapting the Torso graphic novel. Sure. Why not? let's move on to the other story.
Okay.
That Robert Rodriguez is currently in talks to remake Escape from New York.
Mm-hmm.
So here's the thing. fuck yes, take my money now.
Really?
Yeah. Normally I am not about remakes, mm-hmm. But I think this could work. I mean, if anyone could make this work, it's Robert Rodriguez. He mm-hmm. he gets this. And
it is his wheelhouse, for sure.
Yeah, and if we're getting, you know, Grindhouse Rodriguez and not Spy Kids Rodriguez, which I think we would, I mean, you know, he's aware enough to know what project he's working on.
Yeah.
although that would be kind of great. I mean, here's the thing. Kurt Russell is iconic as Snake uh-huh. Plissken. It's going to be hard to replace that. And Escape from New York is great, but it is pretty dated. And Escape mm-hmm. from L.A. is a really good bad movie.
Uh-huh.
And I think Robert Rodriguez is... Yeah, I'm all about this.
You're all about
it. Like I said, not normally into remakes, but this all adds up to, I think, what could be pretty awesome.
Okay. Yeah, I'm of two or three minds on this. Going back to the casting aspect of it, and you know, the Snake Plissken character being iconic and blah blah blah. I've actually heard some rumor about, or maybe it was just kind of bloggy daydreaming. But I've heard some stuff about maybe doing a gender swap on Plissken.
Ooh.
And I think a Michelle Rodriguez Snake Plissken would be pretty cool.
Yeah, I'd be all about that. I mean, she would be great. I could think of a few actresses that could mm-hmm. really kick ass. I mean, we've seen Charlize Theron be a motherfucker,
mm-hmm.
and she's got that new movie Atomic Blonde.
Yeah. Right?
That looks pretty fucking cool. Yeah, I could mm-hmm. be totally into a gender swapped. My only issue is I don't want to deal with like the fanboys.
Yeah, I don't super care about them.
I don't either. It's more just like shut the fuck up. I just don't even want that to exist. But that's not a reason to not do it.
Right, right, right. And I feel like, you know, getting Robert Rodriguez, it's not going to turn into like a comedy all of a sudden or turn into something that it wasn't before. I think he's going to understand that tone. My other hesitation, though, is the Robert Rodriguez factor, only because if we were talking about Robert Rodriguez, like somewhere between Desperado and the first Sin City, yeah, by all means, take my money. But Robert Rodriguez, now he's had a lot of, like, he's been on a losing streak for a while. Well, like, his machete movies,
My question is it Robert Rodriguez the director or Robert Rodriguez the producer? Because to me, he's kind of like Luc Besson. Like, if he's behind the camera, if it's his baby, if it's his project... Mm-hmm. I feel pretty good about it. But if it's like I'm just giving money to some schlup to make, you know, high grade looking action schlock, mm-hmm. I'm not super into that. So it does depend on which Rodriguez we're getting. But I feel like a project like this, mm-hmm. he's probably got a hold pretty close to his heart. I think it would probably be him firing on all cylinders.
All right, well, this is what the tracking board has to say about it. It says they're reporting that none other than Robert Rodriguez is at the top of Fox's wish list for the remake of Escape from New York. According to the outlet, he is currently in early talks to helm the project, helm meaning direct, based upon the latest draft by screenwriter Neil Cross, who also did Luther and Pacific Rim. And the script will likely undergo another rewrite once Rodriguez comes on board. So, he would probably personalize it a little bit to his own standards. And then there's all the, you know, the stuff about him not being in the Directors Guild and how he always makes his films, you know, in his backyard in Austin, essentially, you know,
That's how this should be made.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That's, yeah.
Those Purge movies, especially the second one, I didn't see the third one, but the second one basically was Escape from New York. meets the Punisher, meets the Purge.
I really feel like I would enjoy at least the second two.
Yeah, I mean, that director, I don't think he's very good, but that director, like, he, like, is a huge Carpenter devotee.
I enjoyed the Purge experience at Hollywood Horror Nights, Universal Studios.
Let's get into Ghost in the Shell.
All right.
Do you want to set it up? I can do this. Rupert Sanders is directing this. This is his second feature after Snow White and the Huntsman. The original Snow White and the Huntsman. And it stars Scarlett Johansson as the main character, Major. She's a robot. She was once a human, and now she's a human cyborg. Mind.
She's a fucking cyborg, you piece of shit.
Her once human brain is now inside a robotic body.
That is the whole plot of the fucking movie.
And you know, she's what part of this whole
fuck, she's not a robot.
I think you might be getting lost in the weeds here, but she's part of the government program, a secret government program, or a not so secret government program in the future Tokyo, where you know, they're trying to turn.
I would accept that she's a RoboCop,
basically,
but she's not a robot.
Okay. Duly noted on whether or not she's a robot or a cyborg. You know, she accepts the fact that she's basically a weapon for hire and that she's out there to find terrorists and other bad guys. Along her journey, they run into a cyber terrorist who's able to hack into people's brains. And on this investigation, the more she finds out about her mysterious past. You know, there's a lot of, like, cyberpunky, matrixy looking stuff all over the place. And another excuse for Scarlett Johansson to run around with a gun and a onesie.
Yeah, but she's good at that.
So it's her thing lately.
Yeah.
So what did you think of Rupert Sanders' remake of the 1995 anime, Ghost in the Shell?
Mm-hmm. You know, I was ready to hate it, but I kind of didn't. I definitely had some issues with it. Mm-hmm. We'll get there. But for the most part, I really liked the look of the movie. They did the cyberpunk thing well, which I think a lot of movies don't do that. Like, they kind of introduce it into the first act for, like, some of the establishing shots, but then, like, they forget halfway through and totally lose that aspect. So I thought they did that well. It's been a long time since I've seen the original, and I'm not sure if I've ever seen it all the way through. So I'm not, like, hardcore loyal to the anime. But it would be like, there would be a scene and I would get this. It was almost like an LSD flashback trip of just like, whoa.
Oh, yeah, this.
Yeah. But I wasn't beholden to the source material by any means. I'm not, like, really, you know.
You don't have a checklist of what they're changing and what they're getting right or anything.
Yeah, and there was so much controversy about this movie, and again, remake, live action adaptation, and just, like, on paper, I wasn't into the idea. I don't know that ultimately this movie needs to exist. But if we're judging every movie on based off of needing to exist, then we can cut out a good chunk of cinematic history.
Right.
Yeah, I was engrossed in the story. I appreciated that the movie paced itself. I was kind of afraid that they would, you know, sort of just matrixify it and just make everything like an action set piece. But I, you know, I think a lot of the story made it across, and the action set pieces, I thought were pretty subdued actually, and pretty effective. You know, there wasn't as much violence as I was sort of expecting. And so it made the violent scenes sort of mean more. So, okay. Basically, I was just trying to watch this as a movie, separating right. it from the anime, separating it from the whitewashing controversy, which got more difficult than I thought. but, yeah, overall, I basically enjoyed it.
Okay. I'm going to disagree with you a little on this. I think it's watchable, kind of. But I certainly wasn't thrilled with most of it. I'll give you, Rupert Sanders, he knows visuals. He understands set design. He understands how to create a mood. He knows where to put the camera. He knows how to make these kind of cool looking video, music video moments. And the movies follow those. And the mise-en-scene and the cyberpunky, visual design of the movie and the art direction is all top notch. Very slick, very, well thought out, on an artistic level, visual level. About everything else doesn't do a ton for me. I think the movie, we're kind of coming full circle here. This is like the snake eating its own tail because we had Blade Runner, which was a huge inspiration to Ghost in the Shell, which then was a huge inspiration to The Matrix. And this seems to just kind of take all of the above. Yeah. And jumble it together. And to me, like, there's not enough here that I haven't seen in other movies better. In frankly, very iconic movies at this point, where I can't get past the feeling that I'm just watching a movie made out of other movies. Whether it be a visual idea or whether it be, I mean, it is in, you know, it is a remake.
It's literally a remake.
But it also, I feel like it, like, there's a whole lot of Wachowski action style going on here, which is fine. They were the first ones to kind of visualize what anime would look like in live action.
But again, I guess I cut it a little more slack because the source material influenced the Wachowski. Like, it does get confusing.
Yeah.
It's like, Ghost in the Shell definitely influenced The Matrix. Definitely.
Right,
like,
right. Well, it's very similar to how I felt about John Carter of Mars when that thing came out. You couldn't help but look at John Carter and go, oh god, this is kind of like Stargate and Dune and Star Wars and blah blah blah. But, you know, that character, the pulp character John Carter, was what influenced Stargate and Dune and all of those things. But
I guess, okay, and I also didn't hate John Carter, everyone else did. I didn't love it, but I didn't hate it.
I didn't either. I felt very similar to how I feel about this, which is it's watchable. It's a movie.
Yeah, I mean, what frustrated me was I felt like there were some, and I feel like I say this about a lot of the movies we watch. I felt like there were a few dumb choices that really just took me out of it, and had it not been for those, I enjoyed it a lot more than I was expecting to.
I would have been very similar. Like, I think the first opening sequence with like the geisha, the cyber geishas, was like cool and like visually interesting, and I was like, oh wow. And even like, you know, just conversation set pieces, he knows how to make visually interesting. But I think accumulatively,
I think there was something also though about the script, specifically the dialogue, that didn't translate, because it's literally like translated. And there were moments again of dialogue that I remembered from the anime that seemed especially clunky, said by real people.
Well, you know, the anime and anime in general, it's a very heightened style.
Yes.
And dialogue especially can be very sort of impressionistic. Mm-hmm. We understand as an audience that this is from another culture and we're getting the translation of it. We're able to kind of fill those gaps in our brain and understand, okay, it sounds kind of silly here, but, you know, on the greater scale, this is sort of what it means. When you're doing it with actual American actors, yeah, maybe make it better. Yeah. Also, I feel like, you know, Scarlett Johansson, I'm really not feeling in this movie. And it's not just because she's not Asian. I know that that's the controversy. I really think that's not this movie's problem ultimately, but I think she is from a performance. I don't know how she was directed, because I feel like she was being directed to be robotic or androidic, if you will.
Cyborgic. Jesus fucking Christ.
I don't mean to offend the cyborg community out there.
What the fuck? Okay, so no Netflix homework, because you're just going to have to read, like, all of the collective works of Isaac Asimov.
I've read iRobot.
Then you should know the difference.
So I feel like from a performance level, you know, if we're just talking about all of her roles in the past of her running around with a gun, I've seen her do this a lot more interestingly and with more verve and with more character. And I feel like Rupert Sanders was probably directing her to be less, to have less emotion, but it doesn't come across as like introspective and interior and like brooding. It just comes across as boring. And as a main character, I was never able to sort of enter into her existential crisis about, like, oh, what am I? What is humanity? Blah, blah, blah. Like, even, you know, and not, which isn't to say that, like, you know, Keanu Reeves in The Matrix or Harrison Ford in Blade Runner are, like, these ultra-charismatic wild men, but something about the storytelling is allowing them to be more effective ciphers than she is in this.
I don't know. I kind of disagree with you on that.
Okay.
Keanu Reeves, I'm not saying she was necessarily great in this, but mm-hmm. I there was some stuff about her performance I appreciated. Like, she had a very different physical than I've seen her do before, and there were some times when it was a little weird, like, off-puttingly weird. Like, mm-hmm. she kind of has this weird stomp gait to her walk. I don't know. I could see her sort of physicalizing it, and there were times when I was like, ugh, I can really see her physicalizing this. And then there were other times when I was like, oh, I can really see her physicalizing the role. So, for me, she was kind of a mixed bag. Again, I thought it was about on par with Keanu Reeves in The Matrix, because he real wooden and everything. She is, I think, sort of intentionally, and there are moments when that works and moments where it doesn't. I particularly liked some of the supporting cast, Batow. I don't know how to pronounce it. I liked him a lot, but I also just really like that type of character, like the super loyal sort of grunt character.
He was cool.
And the fucking chief dude, super badass. And you have
Takashi Kitano?
You have to give props for, like, once he whips that fucking Magnum out. I will say, I could watch a whole movie about this guy. Just fucking running rampage in Neo Tokyo as this mm-hmm. fucking Dirty Harry, like, like, come on. Do not tell me that you could not imagine that.
That scene was one of the scenes that woke me up when I was watching the movie.
Yeah, because it was fucking lit.
But it also, unfortunately, pointed out how not lit the rest of the movie was.
The story was solid. You know, you're adapting a story that works. Decent to fine. And what really bothered me was the controversy of this movie sort of was greater than the movie. Like, there, I could not get it out of my head. Especially, we're going to the spoiler town. Departing the train to Spoilerville. Chugga, 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 spoilers. Anyone still listening, you deserve to have it spoiled. Just fast forward, like, 2 minutes, whatever. So, when they revealed her mom, and it's like, no, that's coming from someone who is not underrepresented, in movies and television, mm-hmm. so I get that my voice isn't necessarily the most valid in this argument. But it didn't ruin the movie until that. And I was like, whoa, what the fuck? Like, and her name is super Japanese, like, is very Japanese. And I'm like, the rest of the cast, it was like they intentionally made pretty diverse. Like her partner is like a Russian dude, I think the actor is like Russian or something. The rest of the team is pretty diverse. So I'm like, okay, you know, maybe they're trying to make a statement like in the future, all races kind of blend together, whatever. But then you pull this shit with the mom that calls such attention to it that I'm like, bad fucking choice. Like really made me uncomfortable, and I haven't felt that uncomfortable.
Well, I mean, even small things though, like just dyeing her eyebrows black and giving her this really kind of like Japanese haircut, like just things like that that they didn't have to do that would draw attention to the already.
Well, the haircut, you know, they want to make her look like the character, and that's the character's hair. Like, I get that, but yeah, like. They make her eyes look more Asian. and it's not like a fucking Breakfast at Tiffany's kind of thing. But it is enough that it's like, if you're not gonna go that route, don't go, like, don't try to make us think she's Asian.
I don't think anyone thought that that's what they were doing. But.
It was, and then the villain also was super white. Which, I guess, you know, you don't want to make the villain Asian, because then it's like, oh, then you're vilifying. It is a sticky wicket, this idea.
I'm a white guy here, so, you know, take everything I say with whatever amount of salt you will. But all of that stuff to me felt really, really not the problem. Well, I mean, felt less the problem than the fact that I just, as a story, I couldn't get engaged with it. And, you know, I'm glad that you were able to more than I was, but the way I feel about this, and very similarly to, Rupert Sanders' first movie, the Snow White and the Huntsman.
Blarf.
That one's worse. Blarf. That one's worse. I'll say that.
That was like one of my least favorite movies of that year. Whereas this was like, I was like, oh, all right. That was.
But I feel like he as a person is a very almost kind of like Zack Snyder, where he's a lot more interested in how it looks than how it feels. And he's not really connected to the movie on a story level. He's more just trying to execute set pieces, whether, you know, action set pieces or just, you know.
Well, and I think that comes to the same point as Scarlett Johansson's hair and her eyes. You know, he's trying so hard to get the look of the anime that it's sort of missing some of the point.
Right, and I feel like he's making this kind of homage to just, like, anime and cyberpunk as an aesthetic.
Yeah.
But that's the problem with the movie, is that I feel like it never brings me into the story aspect of it, her journey. I always just feel like there's...
Totally brings me into the Chief's journey.
Yeah.
That dude is a bad.
That one scene is, you know, again, like, that was like this great little mini movie you create in your brain for a little bit to not be in the movie you're watching. It sounds like I hate it more than I do. I don't. I kind of nothing this movie. I would say, like, if it ends up on Spike TV 4 years from now and you're watching it kind of while making dinner, that's probably going to be the most satisfying way to watch this.
I felt the same I did about this movie as I did about, Vin Diesel's Babylon AD and, Jude Law's Repo Men. Actually, I feel like just like Repo Men, because it's like, it's alluding to movies I liked more, but it's still kick-ass enough that I'm like, all right, it's got some cool shit.
Yeah, and it keeps your eyeballs entertained.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So if you're into movies like that, then I would recommend this.
I can't go that far though, because I was so bored. I was significantly bored for a lot of it. So I'm going to say.
I was never bored. I was at best, horrified by whitewashing. At worst horrified by whitewashing. At best, dreaming about, Chief Badass's solo
movie,
six movie franchise, where he's remaking the Dirty Harry movies.
If it were directed by Chanwick Park, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's that.
Moving on?
Yeah, let's...
Oh, letter grade?
Oh, C minus.
Okay, I'd say C plus.
Okay.
So we're about
pretty same. Close, yeah. Okay, so frailty. Do you want to give me the skinny on frailty?
Yeah. So Matthew McConaughey is the man who walks into Powers Booth's office. First, he thinks he's crazy, so he has to tell him his story about how he grew up. He grew up. Bill Paxton plays his dad. And who gets a vision from an angel and is told to gather these holy weapons to kill demons. But these demons appear in human form. But once he lays hands on these demons, he will know the sin in their hearts. And it is his job to destroy them. So that's the framing device. Is this story about how he grew up.
And the majority of the movie actually takes place in the flashback.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what I mean. Most of the movie is the flashback, and then you got the Matthew McConaughey telling the story as the framing device.
Yeah. And we mentioned last week, we might have mentioned, I'm not sure if we did, but this is the only film that Bill Paxton directed. The late Bill Paxton.
I didn't know he directed it. Did you say that last week? I was not listening.
I think I might have. It was one of those like horror thrillers that kind of came and went, but I always kind of heard about it. Like, it has its fans. Mm-hmm. There are people out there who always were like, oh, Frailty, you should see it. It's way underrated, blah, blah, blah. This was as good an excuse as any to watch it. And I had a really interesting journey watching this, because I watched the first half of it, or a little bit more than the first half, maybe like an hour 10 or so of it, before I went to work today, and then before we got started tonight, I watched the rest of it.
Okay.
And I feel like I was really, like, bummed I had to go to work, because I was, like, really in it. Like, I was, like, I thought, like, you know, it's very 2001-ish, like... You know, it feels actually somehow feels a little bit older than it is. Like, it feels like 1996. Like, it dates weird.
Mm-hmm. I thought it was the 90s as well, because it's just sort of shot that way.
And it has that kind of, like, violin score that all the thrillers, like, post Silence of the Lambs had, and they were all kind of aping that Howard Shore score. Mm-hmm. And it has that vibe. The acting's not like amazing by like the kids especially, but I was really just in it as a story. I was like, oh, this is a really interesting thing. Like, you know, so sad. Like, you know, this kid is watching, doesn't believe his father, and like basically watching him become a psychopath in front of his eyes. But he's like, you know, like I was really in it, and I was like, you know, had the movie in my head while my entire 8-hour shift, and then got ready to get back in. And then, you know, I'm not going to give it away, but there's a twist. And I feel like it undoes everything that was interesting about that first half of the movie. Hmm. And it no longer becomes character-oriented, and it gets hokier and hokier by every minute that passes past the twist. And it's a real shame, because I think this could have been a really interesting, cool psycho thriller, and instead it turns into, like, kind of like a... Basically like a bad, like, Twilight Zone writ large.
I think you did yourself a disservice by splitting it up.
Probably.
Because I kind of feel like the whole movie was always that. Like, I don't know. So I could see like, this movie definitely influenced the shit out of some things. Mm-hmm. Like, Ob's Supernatural, holy
shit. Oh, yeah. I was thinking that. I was like, oh, this is the Winchester's origin story.
Yeah, which came out only, like, 5 years later. So, also True Detective. I got, like,
yeah.
you got Matthew McConaughey's Rust Cole sort of before, you know, back when Matthew McConaughey was Matthew McConaughey. That didn't work, but moving on.
Before the McConaissance, yes.
Yeah, before the McConaissance. You know, you got him confessing this dark, sordid tale to, you know, in a police booth. You kind of don't know is he guilty or, you know, like, that suspicion is there.
Right.
Like, thematically very much reminded me of True Detective. Also, definitely, I think, had some influence on Shyamalan, or was influenced by Shyamalan. I'm not sure which came first, which one is the chicken or egg in this situation, but it definitely, like... Yeah. To me, the movie was always building to this twist, and I didn't know what the twist was, but I was like, it's coming. And I just kind of always could tell it was going to be kind of dumb. And there's a couple twists, and it's like, okay, is that real? Or, okay. And I just, it did not work for me, the twists. I thought that was pretty hokey. And I don't know.
Agreed.
I feel like it wasn't ever scary enough or thrilling enough to really work as a thriller, and it wasn't ever dramatic enough to really work as a drama character piece. Like, there were some good moments. I think the story itself was pretty interesting, but I don't know. There was something about the 90s-fication of it. It just kind of felt like... kind of felt like an overly morbid Lifetime original. Like, instead of it being, you know, about this domestic abuse or rape story, it's about this weird supernatural serial killer thing. But it just kind of had that tone for me. Like, the violence wasn't violent enough to ever really shock me. Or, like, I think maybe if we had lived in those horror moments a little more, it might have worked for me a little better. But I was never totally intimidated by Bill Paxton as the dad. I just never really bought it.
I don't know if you're always supposed to be, though. Like,
you're not always.
Like, you're supposed to question.
Yeah,
but. Yeah, you're supposed to genuinely question whether he's doing it for good reasons or bad. I actually think he does a decent job in the movie, given that he's directing himself.
I think his performance is fine. I think it's more the directing issues. It's like, I think the camera kind of pulls away at times when it maybe shouldn't and focuses on the wrong thing. I just never really bought it. I just never bought his, like, I bought that he was a conflicted guy. I bought that, you know, he was like, thought he was doing the right thing, but I never bought him as, like, this sort of religious fanatic, this religious zealot. I don't know if that makes sense at all, but, like, I bought the dad role. I didn't buy the killer zealot role.
Yeah. I don't know. That's the thing. That's my problem with the twist in general. It feels like it was almost kind of written by two people with two different intentions for the story. Because I feel like the first half is making more of a point about
I felt it building to a twist the entire time.
I felt that it was, I mean, it's a thriller and it's clearly pulpy, so I knew that it was gonna go somewhere, and I knew that it was gonna wrap back around into the framing device and this new serial killer. I knew all of that was gonna happen, but I felt like it would thematically be in sync. And that's what where I felt like the twist is weird, because it takes everything I thought about those characters, and I know that that's kind of the point of the twist, but it changes them in such a way that makes them way less interesting as characters.
No, I agree. I was like, and, oh, okay.
And also makes the story a lot more fucked up, and not in like a good, cool way.
Yeah, I...
Like in a like reprehensible way.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there is still like this, the thing I like about the twist is it does still leave this sort of question hanging out in the air. It's like, what's real and what's not. I just didn't really care for it. I was like, especially the thing with the FBI agent. I was like, oh, that's kind of dumb.
Right, yeah.
But, yeah, I don't know. I thought the whole thing was just kind of pulpy, and it was fine. Like, I would watch this movie again.
You would?
I don't know. I wasn't, like, blown away by it. It wasn't scary enough to scare me. It wasn't thrilling enough to thrill me. It was just kind of like, I think it might be kind of a fun Halloween movie or whatever, you know?
Yeah, I mean, at this point, yeah, I felt like it could have been more than that, but it didn't. I see its cult appeal. I understand why people still talk about this movie, not just because Bill Paxton directed and he just died, but I see kind of like, this is one of those movies, kind of like The Machinist, or kind of like, I don't know, a great deal of Christian Bale movies prior to Batman. Where they all have that same kind of cult appeal, but you watch them and you're like, oh, I see the cool idea here, but it doesn't totally work. And that's kind of how I feel about this movie. I'm a little disappointed. I'm just disappointed because I was really in it at a point. There was a point where, yeah, I was able to overlook the production values and the kind of the hokiness of it all, because I felt as a story, I was sort of hooked. And then I felt I was betrayed by that. So I'm a little more mad at the movie than I would like to be. But I think that if you've never seen it, it's worth taking a look at.
Yeah. Yeah, so Netflix homework, before we go. Did you guys ever review Paddington?
The bear movie?
Yeah.
No.
That's our homework. Paddington.
Okay. We'll talk about that next week. Well, that's the movies. And do you have anywhere you want to direct people?
Tonight in San Diego, as always. Check us out, tonightinsandiego.com. You can find us on Twitter, Facebook, Tonight in San Diego. You can follow me on Twitter at Keith Foster Kid. Follow me on Instagram. I think I'm going to try... this might be a fun thing. I think the next time we do Netflix homework, I think I'm going to try to live tweet it.
Okay.
So keep your eyes out for that. I'll probably do a hashtag or something. I don't know. Follow me and I'll direct your attention to when I do it, if I in fact do that. Okay. So that's the softest plug ever.
Oh, that's the thing we forgot, is you never gave me Netflix homework.
Oh, I have one. I don't know if you've seen it before, but let me get through my plugs.
Okay.
Also, Tonight in San Diego is doing a stand-up and improv show. This isn't a taping. This is just, there's a lot of stand-up comedians, a lot of improv comedians, and we're doing, like, our own show that's just that. There's no, like, guest interviews or anything, or musical guests. In Julian on April 22nd at 6:30 p.m.,
okay.
Is in Julian, California, so it's a little bit east of San Diego. It's at 6:30. I believe it's a free show, and it's at Winola Pizza and Bistro. So if you happen to be in Julian, come check that out. And I believe we're going to try to do a few more shows like this that aren't TV tapings, but are just comedy and improv sort of variety shows. So keep your eyes out for those. We have one more live taping of Tonight in San Diego and then we're taking a little bit of break. So the last live taping is, next Monday, 17th, And then we're off for a month, 4 weeks. Thank God. And then we're back at it for another 12 episodes. So come to a live taping. I feel like the live shows don't get plugged enough. Yeah. And then just watch the show.
Okay, cool. As always, you can follow the show at Jabber Podcast on Twitter. You can follow me at BC Cassidy. You can find the show's archives and the RSS feed at jabberandthedrone.podbean.com. You can also find us on Stitcher, iTunes, Pocket Cast, the Windows Podcast Network, Google Play, and other things like that. We have some friends who also do podcasts. You should be listening to them, Rod and Denise at the Listening Party. Yeah. Denise is...
they're so nice.
They are very nice. Denise has her side project, the Mascot Diaries. She has a few new episodes up for that. And Patrick at Make Dad Read Comics and Almost Educational.
All right. And as always, as they should do with Snake Plissken in the remake of Escape from New York, give it to Gosling.
I don't think I can agree with that, but okay. Bye.
Give it to Gosling.